Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We hear the warnings, we see and can feel the changes in the landscape. Each year, it seems the green grass turns yellow earlier in the season. The winds are stronger for longer periods of time. And this summer, we are reminded again of the threat of catastrophic wildfires. That is a familiar warning due to severe drought conditions that this can once again be among the most dangerous on record. Cal Fire, in turn, is gearing up. They are hiring thousands of additional firefighters. In the meantime, people living in the foothills, Sierra, and communities like Paradise and other parts of Butte County are preparing for the worst, and for good reason. I covered many of those fires as a reporter over the past several years, from the Detweiler fire in Mariposa County to Coffee Park in Santa Rosa, the Car Fire in Redding, the Camp Fire consuming the towns of Paradise, Magalia, Polga, and Concow, and the relentless Lightning Complex wildfires last year, burning the Central Valley up through the coast to the Oregon border. The weight of devastation is still very much visible. Rebuilding is still taking place with challenges, and the word unimaginable to describe these wildfires no longer has a place. But preparing is still happening like clockwork. Joining us now with fresh reporting from Butte County on how Cal Fire, emergency responders, and the community are gearing up for this season is Cap Radio's Scott Rodd. We're also going to talk about how the drought is impacting Lake Oroville, dealing just another economic blow to the community and surrounding businesses. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Scott, people who live in Butte County, I mean, it's like deja vu, you know, clockwork every summer. They've heard the warnings. What is the mood there now?
Well, fire is woven into this community, into the fabric of it. You know, it's everywhere you look. I stopped at a taco stand for lunch, and the folks waiting for their order were from a tree removal service. And right now they're busy removing brush and other fire fuels from around houses. I stopped into a bar and next door, and the conversation just throughout the whole time I was there was about fires and about the concerns of what this fire season is going to look like coming up, and also what past fires were like. And, you know, folks were talking about bringing their valuables and their most prized possessions to storage units away from fire-prone areas so they didn't have to worry about trying to shepherd them out if a fire struck. And it's this blend of kind of anxiety and routine where, you know, there's an acceptance that fire is just a reality in this area, but there's also resilience to it. There's this attitude that they're not going to bow down to the dangers of fire. They're there to stay, and they're going to stick it through.
Right. I mean, I think when you go up there time and time again, what anchors, despite the anxiety and stress, is that the feeling of home and community is worth the risk, and that sense of resiliency, especially given the past 3 years have just been devastating in these burn areas and surrounding areas. So how has the area recovered? How are they recovering currently?
There certainly is resilience, but it's been a tough recovery. You know, this rebuilding doesn't happen overnight. And in some cases, it doesn't happen over the course of months or even years. And you can still see these fire scars, you know, visible in the forest as these sort of visible reminders of how destructive these fires were. I spoke to a woman named Sissy Savoy. She's living on a tent on her best friend's property, and her best friend, his house burned down. And I spoke to her about why they're rebuilding up there and what her commitment is to this place.
He barely got out, you know, with not even a shirt on his back, and his dog, like, had to drive through a wall of fire to get out. A lot of people didn't make it out, so I think we're all pretty blessed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you say blessed even though you lost pretty much everything.
Yeah.
I guess tell me, why do you feel blessed?
I mean, we still have this opportunity to heal the land and, you know, maintain our friendships, and we have our family.
Conditions right now are pretty bad in terms of fires. People are saying, you know, fires aren't going to go anywhere anytime soon.
Right.
Climate change is obviously
right.
bad.
Yeah.
But you want to rebuild. I guess tell me, why do you want to rebuild up here?
I was sitting up outside of my tent the other night looking at the trees. A lot of people go up there and think it's really ugly, you know, so I'm scarred, damaged. Maybe I relate to that, my own scars and damage, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of people love me back to health, so.
Are you nervous at all knowing, like, you just go to the lake and look how low it is?
Right.
There already have been a bunch of fires, small ones this year, but a bunch. Do you feel nervous?
A little bit. I mean, we're not tapping water in our wells. Usually that doesn't happen till August. It's really early this year. Nervous about my safety? No. Get out, you know?
And that to me, just this, again, commitment to place, but this confidence that, you know, we're going to stay here, and if a fire comes, we'll find our way out. That to me sort of captured the mentality of folks who have stuck around in this area. And I guess just to clarify one thing in our conversation, there have been many fires across the state, not in Butte County necessarily, but a bunch of small ones so far this year.
Right. This is just compounded with back-to-back dry years. We're emerging from what is meant to be our wet season. We have severe drought across 94% of the state. Some areas, three-quarters of the state, are experiencing extreme drought. That essentially means fire season, the threat of fires, is year-long. We know that the foothills are bone dry. When you took the trip up there, what does the landscape look like in the areas that you visited?
You know, the grass is crispy and yellow. It crunches underfoot. The brush and the overgrowth, you can see it in the forest. There are some dead trees. There are also torched trees from, you know, the massive North Complex fire last year. And CAL FIRE and others are working on vegetation management projects in this area around Lake Orville and certainly other areas around the state. But the clock is ticking. And, you know, frankly, there's more fuel reduction and prescribed burns that have to happen than there are hours in the day. And, you know, according to Alex Hall, who's the director of the Center for Climate Science at UCLA, you know, these conditions are all around the state, and it's a troubling sign.
We have had an abnormally dry water year in the past 9 months or so, and it has resulted in very, very low snowpack levels. We're somewhere around 15% of normal. So we have a lot less water flowing into reservoirs than normal. As the dry season rolls around, we'll have much earlier dry conditions than normal, and that will lead to elevated fire risk much earlier in the season than normal. And probably once we get to the heart of the fire season, we'll see elevated fire risk across most of the state of California.
And, you know, that suggests fires potentially in areas that weren't necessarily fire prone before. And as I mentioned earlier, there have already been more fires in 2021 than there were this time last year. And again, just as a reminder, last year was one of the worst on record. So that's an indication of some of the concern and potential danger of this fire season coming up.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about that, Scott, when I was looking at the drought monitor this morning, the same time last year, 40% of the state had zero drought conditions. Now we're talking about 94% of the state experiencing severe drought. Now that leads us to preparation. I mean, what is CAL FIRE doing? We know that they're hiring, but do they actually think they're going to have enough people, enough aircraft this year?
You know, there's probably no such thing as enough necessarily. I mean, California is so big. The terrain can be very rugged, and there are just so many fires that can break out. However, you know, they are hiring. They are hiring, and they're hiring earlier. And I spoke to CAL FIRE's PIO, Robert Foxworthy, and here's what he said that the department's doing.
One of our big ones is we're hiring early hire over 1,200 additional firefighters that are going to go mainly to hand crews. So that's a big one that we've seen years in the past of how successful some of those fuel reduction projects have been at stopping some of these larger fires. And we're bringing on these hand crews earlier to have them up and staffed. And until they're actually out there fighting fire and doing fire suppression, they're going to be doing fuel reduction projects. Another one that we've done this year is we've hired all of our HeliTAC firefighters earlier. Those are specialized firefighters that are just assigned to our helicopters.
And, you know, last year, you'll remember there were crews and firefighters shuttled from one major fire to the next, you know, weeks on end with sometimes little or no time off in between.
Yeah, they were just exhausted. And it's actually great to hear that they're getting more aircraft, especially when we're talking about wildfires that work their way into steep, rugged terrain where it's really hard to get to on foot. And this aircraft is really a game changer when visibility and other weather conditions are right. Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd on the wildfire danger in Northern California. When talking about the drought, we have already went to Folsom Lake, and we had the superintendent there. heading over to Lake Oroville, I mean, that's part of the drought as well. What is the situation with the water level there, and how is that impacting boaters and recreation?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want a visual representation of the drought, look no further than Lake Oroville. The water level is 130 feet below normal. The water capacity is at 48% of its historical average for this time of year. And I took a tour of the lake on a pontoon. And as you're sort of going through on the water and through some of the houseboats, you have these just big looming embankments where typically the water would be up to the shoreline, but you feel like you're in a canyon. I mean, 130 feet vertically is one thing, but a shoreline is at an angle. And so you see just how low the water is. And, you know, right now is when the water is supposed to be at its highest in the year. So it's only going to drop from here. I spoke to the general manager of a marina as well as a houseboat owner out there, and they said that they're going to have to pull out about 100 houseboats just in the next few weeks because they're concerned that this water is going to continue to drop quickly. And if it keeps dropping at the rate it does, some of these boats could run aground and be wrecked. And so the marina is trying to incentivize some of these boat owners to get them off, to offer free storage and reduced costs to get them out of the water. But this really will be a blow to the local economy because it depends on these summer visitors, these summer travelers who are going to these houseboats, but who are also recreating at the lake. And right now, it's hard to recreate at a lake that kind of looks like a puddle.
And spending money at the surrounding businesses. Well, the governor has allocated a significant amount of money toward the firefight and mitigation efforts with the drought and the wildfire risk. How much money are we talking about, and where exactly is the money going to go to?
So Governor Newsom has already allocated over half a billion dollars in early budget spending on wildfires. And so that's going towards the hiring that we discussed earlier, as well as some of the vegetation management and fuel reduction projects, prescribed burns. And he's also proposing over $5 billion to address the drought in this year's budget. That'll go towards things like drinking water and wastewater infrastructure improvement projects, groundwater recycling and cleanup, natural habitat and wildlife restoration. Now, the legislature will be debating that proposal, and they'll have about a month or so to come to a conclusion.
We as individuals also play a role in this, right? And especially when talking about defensible space and being prepared for the wildfire risk. When you talk to CAL FIRE, what message do they have for the community?
Well, it's frankly, the best time to prepare was probably yesterday, but the next best time is today. And I spoke to, again, CAL FIRE PIO, Robert Foxworthy, and here's what he said residents can do to make sure that they're ready for this year's wildfire season.
Now is the time to get out and start doing those home hardening projects. Make your home safer now, so if there is a wildfire, it has a better chance of surviving that wildfire. Now is the time that they go out and do the clearing up next to their homes and getting on their ladders and making sure their gutters aren't full of leaves and needles and things like that. Now is also the time for the public to get your evacuation plan put in place. Last thing you want is to be surprised by a wildfire and then try to figure out how I'm going to get out and where I'm going to go when you're in the middle of a wildfire. Now is the time to get your go bag ready. So when it's time to go, all you have to do is walk to your closet and grab your bag of your medicines and your important paperwork. When that wildfire comes, you're not going to be able to remember to go get all those things. So when it is time, it's quick and you can quickly get out of the area. So then the firefighters can come in and concentrate on extinguishing the fire.
And, you know, Foxworthy says that you don't want to assume that your area won't be the area that'll be hit by fire. You want to be prepared because, as we've seen, these fires can strike and really just about anywhere in California.
Yeah, especially when having an exit route, because when talking about rural communities, there may just be one or two main ways to get out of town. When you think of the campfire, you remember the lines of vehicles, bumper to bumper, fighting to escape the wildfire, because they really only had Skyway or Highway 191 to get out of town. Cap Radio, Scott Rodd, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your reporting from Butte County.
Thanks for having me on.
Up next, in a race full of seasoned politicians, a Sacramento civil rights activist and pastor decides it's time to run for office in the state capitol. Our conversation with Dr. Tikoi Porter is next. Plus, fact-checking. It is a tough line of work, and even more so now. We're joined by Cap Radio's PolitiFact team with some of their latest assignments, including a zinger about Vice President Kamala Harris, President Biden, and money from China. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California's 6th Senate District, it's a big one. It's encompassing much of Sacramento County, West Sacramento, and Elk Grove. Dr. Richard Pan, who currently holds the seat, is going to be termed out next year, and there are several candidates who are already lining up announcing they want to take his place. They include Sacramento City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Angelique Ashby, Sacramento City Council member Eric Guerra, former California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones, and Tikoi Porter. Last week, we spoke with Mayor Pro Tem Ashby. Today, we're going to have a conversation with Sacramento activist and pastor of Genesis Church in South Sacramento, Dr. Tikoi Porter. Dr. Porter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Vicki. Glad to be here.
Dr. Porter, you made your announcement that you're going to be running for state senate on Martin Luther King's birthday weekend. You're an activist, a pastor, a teacher. Why is politics calling you now?
Well, Vicki, around this time last summer, I was invited to speak at the Sacramento Peace March to provide closing remarks and a prayer. And the march was organized by Sacramento NAACP in response to the killing of George Floyd. You know, I had just come off the plane from helping out with George Floyd's funeral in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the night before, and decided to bring my entire family to the march that next morning. The march turned out to be one of the largest protests in California at the time, with 50,000 people in attendance, all at the height of the pandemic. And we marched from Golden One Center right down Capitol Plaza, past the front of the Capitol, to Cesar Chavez Park for the rally where I would speak. And when I was called to give my remarks and the closing prayer, I found myself standing on the stage in front of all of these beautiful people, a tapestry of Black, white, Latino, Asian, gay, and straight folks in awe, frankly, just in awe. And right at that moment, I hear the words of my mentor, Reverend L. Sharpton, ringing in my head, saying that demonstration must lead to legislation. And that's when I realized that I need to not just be marching past the Capitol, but be elected to be inside of the Capitol, making change people are calling for.
You also started the Sacramento chapter of the National Action Network, a civil rights organization following the shooting death of Stephon Clark. Where has California fallen short when it comes to police reform? And also, can you point to any recent successes that give you hope?
Well, on police reform, we all want to feel safe, right? In our homes, our schools, our neighborhoods, which is why we need to hold our public safety officers accountable for fair policing in all communities. You know, we've done some work and we've made some progress with AB 392 and some recent things that's happened on city council. But when I learned that Eric Guerra endorsed Sacramento DA Amy Schubert for her reelection back in 2018, shortly after the police killing up Stephon Clark, you know, I was disappointed. You know, Schubert has a history of not holding the police accountable, and she filed no charges against the police in the police shooting of Stephon Clark. And to me, Eric Garrett is not a credible voice on police reform. And frankly, neither is Angela Gashby, because she is in the pockets of the police unions. And that's why my leadership is necessary. The issues of police reform and racial violence are more than just footnotes and deserve leadership that will take them on in a serious manner.
When talking about your opponents, it is a diverse field. All of them, including yourself, are Democrats. And you touched upon what's going to make you different. But can you elaborate more specifically on what's going to set you apart from them?
Well, let's talk about, you know, experience. You know, as a pastor, community leader, I've worked with everyday people facing everyday problems for 22 years. I've created and implemented various outreach programs to address food and clothing insecurity, educational health inequities, with after-school programs, youth and leagues to get our kids off the streets, and a social justice organization to address racial violence and police misconduct, as you've noted. You know, name it. In my 22 years, I've probably done it to try to help our people. And as a private citizen, I've also been instrumental in having millions of dollars invested into the Metairie community through the construction of our multi-purpose center, the Dr. Robert Porter Center, and most recently, through a partnership to construct a new elementary school on our campus, Sequoia Porter College Prep. I'm honored to have it named after me, and it serves up to 400 children. And that's just part of my experience. You know, in contrast to this, Eric Garrett and Angela Gashby, who both sit on the council and have done so far for a number of years, have failed to address homelessness effectively in Sacramento. And we see evidence of this every day. In fact, they have placed the burden of housing the homeless on the city's most vulnerable communities, like Meadowview, Del Paso Heights, and Oak Park. And in the meantime, Ashby, who is the senior member of the council with over 10 years experience, is being celebrated for putting up a multi-million dollar water park in her district. How does a water park help with the unhoused? And I'm wondering if this is the type of experience that we want to elevate to the Capitol.
Last week, Angela Gashby, the mayor pro tem, she did say that she built more housing in her district than surrounding districts when discussing building and infrastructure. And we're going to have Councilmember Eric Garrett on next week, as well as Dave Jones, who is the former insurance commissioner. You, Angela Gashby, also brought up a point about experience, and you touched upon that, so I'm going to address it, that essentially she has more experience. And when you look at Eric Garrett, who's a council member, Dave Jones was a former City of Sacramento council member, and then the California's insurance commissioner. What is your response to the argument that they are seasoned politicians and you are new in this field?
Well, you know, their experience means more of the same. And to me, it's the very evidence that proves that we need a fresh start. You know, as far as Dave Jones, you know, it's time for just fresh leadership. Today's issues call for leadership who is more in touch with the people. And I believe that we can no longer afford to play the tag your it game in California politics and elevate people to certain positions because they simply think it's their turn. That's why my experience serving everyday people for 22 years and counting steps in. You know, I'm that fresh start.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Tecoy Porter on his candidacy for State Senate District 6. Let's turn to COVID. In a recent interview, you said that COVID recovery is going to be one of your top priorities. While not in an elected role, but certainly as a community leader, what kind of things are you advocating for to help your community bounce back?
Yeah, you know, COVID has disproportionately impacted Black and brown communities in a huge way. This is no secret. And so, you know, let's be frank here. Let's not kid ourselves. It's going to take a minute for us to come back and build back better in all of California from COVID, in our education, our job loss, you know, make sure that we have health equity and figure out how to solve the financial insecurities that were brought about and exacerbated from COVID. And so that's what I would do, just continue to fight to make sure those fundings from the state and from the federal government gets to the right places in our district, to the right communities, and to the right hands, so we all can bounce back better.
Public health officials are concerned about vaccine uncertainty. How do you think they should better handle closing that gap? In Sacramento County and the surrounding counties, a recent survey we conducted, nearly 40% of individuals are still unsure about getting the vaccine. So how do you curb that?
We just got to keep on partnering with trusted voices in the community. You know, I've spoken up. I've been on many of boards, councils I'm personally working with Councilman my Vang in my district to try to make sure that everyone gets vaccinated. I've been vaccinated myself, and I've just been spreading the word to make sure that, one, we understand that vaccinations is the way out of this pandemic. You know, according to our officials, health officials, you know, it's not just a way, but it is the way. And so we need to make sure that people know this, understand that it's safe, and understand that it's vital for us to do this so that we all can bounce back better.
Finally, where do you stand on the expected recall vote of Governor Newsom?
Well, I don't support it at all. I noticed that Governor Newsom is working hard to keep his job. Listen, nobody's been through a pandemic before, right? So there was no blueprint. And so I support him. I like his universal basic income proposals that he's doing. I've had a chance to hear Andrew Yang talk about his ideas in the area during the 2020 Democratic presidential primary, and I think it'll be a good for Californians. And I think that, including what else has been proposed by Governor Newsom and the surplus and this plan of coming back is good. And so I support Governor Newsom wholeheartedly.
Dr. Tecoy Porter, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you.
Next Thursday, State Senate candidate, Councilmember Eric Guetta will join us, and former Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones will join us 2 weeks from today. All of our candidate interviews can be found on the Insight page on capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And you may have seen some new bylines on Cap Radio's fact checks over the past few weeks. That's because we've added three new contributors from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism to help fact check misinformation on social media. Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, along with students Bella Fertel and Stephen Rascon and Sasha Hupka, are all here to talk about this initiative.
Oh, they're all together, so we're probably next then.
Chris, we're going to start off with you. Before we meet with the students, remind us about Cap Radio's efforts debunking false information on Facebook and on Instagram.
Sure, and great to be here, Vicky. This is a project that we started last summer through a partnership with Facebook. And Facebook contracts with fact checkers like Cap Radio's PolitiFact California and others around the world to investigate and debunk false information on its platform. And we spent a lot of time last year calling out misinformation about the election with a focus on posts that were spreading rapidly on both Facebook and Instagram. And we also fact-checked claims about COVID-19 and vaccinations. And we do this because we know that people get a lot of their news today from social media. And those posts can influence how people vote, how they make other important decisions.
What role does Facebook actually play in the fact-checking that's being done?
Well, Facebook does not decide what Cap Radio should fact-check, nor does it have a role in the ratings that we select. Its users flag questionable posts, including videos and memes, and we have access to a large database of all of those. We select the ones to fact-check, and the reporting and the ratings are all produced by the journalists here at Cap Radio. Once we submit a fact check to Facebook, the company adds it to the offending post and they create a warning label about that false information. You might have seen that on your Facebook newsfeed. And then finally, Facebook slows down the spread of those posts. And last month, Cap Radio contracted with our three UC Berkeley graduate students to produce more of these fact checks.
All right, well, let's get right to it. We're going to begin with Stephen Rascon, a graduate student at UC Berkeley's School of Journalism. Welcome to Insight, Stephen.
Hi, Vicky. Happy to be here.
Well, Stephen, you fact-checked a story about whether face masks cause serious health problems in children. How did you find out about this story?
Yeah, so this past Monday, parents in Orange County held a rally outside of the county's Department of Education, and they were protesting wearing face masks in classrooms. And this event was publicized in a Facebook group called Informed Parents for California. This group, which has more than 52,000 Facebook users, circulated a flyer for the rally with a list of false health claims. And one of those claims was that face masks may cause pulmonary fibrosis, which experts have told us that they found no evidence of. And I should add that since the summer of 2020, PolitiFact has repeatedly debunked claims of face masks causing adverse health effects.
All right. So then how does this debunked information end up on a flyer promoting a rally against face masks?
Right. So the false health claims listed on the flyer actually came from a theoretical paper that also falsely claimed to be associated with Stanford University. The paper was shared by the conservative news outlet Gateway Pundit, and it had the headline, "Stanford study results, face masks can cause health deterioration and premature death," posing the false argument that face masks cause more harm than good. PolitiFact fact-checked this, the origin of this story and the theoretical paper back in April. And they found that Stanford University had no affiliation with any of the paper's findings. We also found that the paper was published in a journal called Medical Hypothesis, which is a journal for radical, speculative, and non-mainstream scientific ideas. And these papers are not peer-reviewed.
Yeah, and that's really difficult for someone who's reading something on social media to kind of go through that fact-checking themselves. When it came to yourself, what did you make sure to cover when doing this fact-checking?
Exactly. We've done some extensive reporting on this in the past, but what I made sure to do was check the specific claims that had not been debunked specifically. So in this case, we hadn't talked to anybody about pulmonary fibrosis, which is a disease that causes scar tissue in the lungs. So I spoke to David Cornfield, who's the head of pulmonary asthma and sleep medicine at Stanford Children's Health. And he confirmed there's no evidence of face masks causing any respiratory damages.
Yeah, I mean, as a fact checker, I mean, just listening to everything you found out is kind of like a rabbit hole of misinformation. How important is it and how difficult is it to trace the origins of misinformation?
I'd say it's really important because when you connect the dots, you can see how one piece of misinformation can influence another. And that helps to inform what you're fact checking. A lot of the claims we fact check on Facebook and Instagram stem from an inaccurate claim. For instance, this false Stanford study, and that goes viral online and then gets picked up by a Facebook group, like the one in the story, and continues to mislead people. It can really turn into a bad game of telephone.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Stephen, thank you so much for your fact checking.
No problem.
All right, we're going to turn our conversation to our next fact checker, Bella Fertel. So, Bella, you fact checked a claim about COVID vaccines and vaccine breakthrough infections. Where did you find this story?
So, Facebook flagged a post on Instagram that claimed that the death rate for fully vaccinated people who get COVID is significantly higher compared to people who didn't get vaccinated. And the account that made that post is pretty popular and has been flagged before for posting false information about COVID. The post claimed that the death rate for fully vaccinated people sick with COVID is significantly higher, which is totally false. And what was interesting about this post, and made it different from the other misinformation about vaccines that's out there, is that it included a screenshot of actual accurate data from the CDC on vaccine breakthrough infections. But what made it misleading was how the author of the post used this data to undermine the effectiveness of vaccines and claim that the vaccine makes people more likely to die if they get sick with COVID.
Right. I mean, I think that just kind of hits to the point that numbers are nothing without context. So even if it comes from the CDC, it can be misleading. What did you want to make sure to let people know when writing this fact checking?
Right, exactly. I wanted people to know that, yes, the figures in the post about the amount of vaccinated people who have gotten sick with COVID and died are real. But the way that the Post was using this misinformation, this information was so misleading and so harmful because it might prevent some folks from actually going out and getting vaccinated and protecting themselves. And there's absolutely zero evidence that vaccinated people are more likely to be hospitalized or die if they get sick with COVID.
Yeah, and vaccine uncertainty, we were just talking about that, is an overarching issue for public health officials. Anything in particular that really surprised you while writing this story?
Something that sort of took me by surprise was that when I talked to public health experts about the same vaccine breakthrough case figures, they had the complete opposite reaction as the author of the Post I was fact-checking. While the Post said that data showed that the vaccine was dangerous and potentially lethal, the health experts said that the data actually shows that the vaccines are, in some ways, more effective in real life than they were in the studies. And what they meant by that was that from the original studies, we thought that the mRNA vaccines were about 90% effective, meaning that one out of every 10 people who got vaccinated, one of those people would end up infected with COVID. And in real life, the amount of vaccinated people reporting breakthrough infections is actually much less than that. So in that regard, these breakthrough cases just prove how effective the vaccine actually is.
What was the most difficult thing about writing this story?
There's so much bad information and misleading posts out there about the coronavirus and the vaccines, so it can be overwhelming and feel like an uphill battle trying to convince people that vaccines are safe. So I wanted to acknowledge that context and that we've checked other claims about vaccine effectiveness before and found them to be false. And I think when we talk about vaccines or anything medical, sometimes things can get really jargony. So I wanted to make sure that I was explaining things in a way that people who didn't get the chance to speak to public health experts could understand, and that was accessible.
Bellis, thank you so much for your work and your fact-checking.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation with our next fact-checker, Sasha Hupka. To start, Sasha, what is the biggest challenge you face while fact-checking?
For me, I think it's knowing when I have enough information, because sometimes it's hard for me to figure out when I'm ready to stop researching and stop talking to people and actually start the writing process. So for instance, there's this one fact check I was working on recently where a Facebook post alleged that Vice President Kamala Harris had told President Joe Biden during the Democratic debates that his son, Hunter Biden, had gotten money from the Chinese government. And so because of that, President Biden would do whatever China wanted if he were elected. And that quote was totally made up, but I remember spending tons of time going through the transcripts of the debates, looking for any comments that might have been made on the campaign trail, and reaching out to Harris's spokespeople, knowing that this quote might be completely fake, but worrying that I might have missed something somewhere. And obviously, I also needed to explain the circumstances surrounding Hunter Biden and what we know about what actually happened there, since that situation influenced this misinformation.
Yeah. So when you, I mean, you have a completely fake quote like that, when do you know when to stop?
Eventually, I ended up just trying to figure out where the quote originated from in the first place, and I tracked it back using, you know, some pretty heavy-duty Google skills, and realized that it had first been mentioned online a few months ago by this random Twitter account. And once I knew that, I was pretty comfortable that I wasn't missing anything, and I could make a really bulletproof case that none of anything with that quote was real.
Mm. And that came from an account, and it clearly spread to Facebook. It went viral. It's presented as fact pretty quickly. And even when it gets corrected, it's already out there and the damage has been done. So to you, what does that say about the spread of misinformation?
Well, the account that I traced it back to and some of the accounts that had shared it on Twitter and on Facebook was a lot of these accounts were very clearly politically motivated accounts. Many of them seemed to, based on their bios, run towards the right-wing side of things. And the quote also didn't just spread to Facebook. It was mentioned in blog posts and in other spots online after the account tweeted it out. I think that tells me that there is this whole ecosystem that easily magnifies false or misleading information, whether that's consciously or unconsciously. But what's honestly more interesting to me is that Many people commented on these posts, and some said that they did absolutely remember this quote, even though that quote was never said. But there are also others that were saying that they didn't remember it, and they were asking if anyone had a source. And that second group of people, the ones trying to figure out whether this did actually happen or not, tells me that people do care about what's true and what isn't true and what might be misinformation and what isn't. But they don't necessarily have the research skills to actually go digging for themselves. And as a fact checker, I'd like to think that those people are the ones that I'm writing for. By just writing one article, I can have such an impact. And that's a really great feeling amid all the vitriol that we often see online.
Well, Sasha, really appreciate that perspective and also all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
All right, Chris, what else is PolitiFact California working on?
Well, aside from all of the great work that our students talked about on the social media initiative, we are keeping tabs on statements by Governor Gavin Newsom, as well as claims by the major candidates running in the recall election. Today in our weekly Can You Handle the Truth segment, we explored the governor's claim that California has a $75 billion budget surplus. That has been questioned by his recall challengers, and so we took a close look at that figure. And that segment will air again this afternoon.
And where can people find Cap Radio's fact checks?
All of our work, including the fact checks by Stephen, Bella, and Sasha, can be found online at capradio.org/PolitiFact.
Chris Nichols, PolitiFact California fact checker, thank you so much. And really thanks to the team that you have assembled of fact checkers at UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
Well, thank you very much, Vicky. Great to be here.
All right, up next, Bears in Folsom. It's actually the Bernstein Bears, and the classic book series is now a musical. We're going to learn about the latest production from Sutter Street Theater next. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, in a typical year, Folsom Sutter Street Theater would normally see over 10,000 guests back into its performance hall. This past year, of course, have been nothing near normal, but the lights are finally back on. The actors are coming back, and so are the audiences. And right now, you can catch the classic stories of the Bernstein Bears come to life at the historic Sutter Street Theater. You and your kids might be familiar with the theme song from the TV show on PBS. The kind of furry around the torso. They're a lot like people, only more so. The bare fact is that they're just like you and me. The only difference is. Yeah, the family of grizzly bears who live under a treehouse in bear country. So, Mike Jimena is managing director of the theater and also set and lighting designer for Bernstein. Mike also directs some of the shows. We're also joined with Connie Mockenhaupt, the artistic director who directs and choreographs the shows. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, before we get to your latest production, let's begin with some history of Sutter Street Theater. If you can just share that, since it is a historic theater in Folsom.
Yeah, we've been here for 15 years. And actually, Folsom, when they did their renovation of the historic district, came and asked us to put the theater down here. And it's really been a wonderful experience. The people in Folsom are terrific. And our audiences are fantastic. And we have some of the greatest actors and kids and everything. We're having a good time.
Yeah, we were asked by the city of Folsom to put the theater down here because they were about to do the revitalization and redevelopment of Sutter Street. And it feels like, you know, to be a draw down here. So as everything was tore up, the businesses didn't go out of business. Well, it feels like we're doing a revitalization again as we're trying to bring everybody down.
Out of COVID, right.
Especially right now, if you get a chance on the weekends, come down, because with the streets closed and stuff, it feels like downtown Disney, kind of a Wild West version of it.
I highly recommend it. I was actually there on Sunday, and it's right. I love having the streets closed, and you have so much good food and good stores, and yeah, it does have a kind of Disney feel. When it comes to your latest production, Bernstein Bears, you know, we know it's based off the books, but how are you putting your own spin on it?
Well, every show you do, you put your own spin on it, one way or another. Mm. This one we had mounted already right when COVID hit, and we had done 2 weeks only. And we have most of the original people back. We had to replace a couple that were no longer in town. But yeah, we're going with it. It's an adorable show. It's several of the stories, several of the books made into a story and told by Cowboy Joe. And Cowboy Joe sits up on top of a platform mm-hmm. and plays the guitar and the keyboards and accompanies the music. It's a musical. Yeah. So it's a lot
Brady
of fun.
Brady Tate did a marvelous job of putting the music all together. And then Laura Luke, who's our director, directed both times. And it's just a fun show. Yeah. It's in our family series, which is not kiddies theater. It's theater for the whole family.
Right.
We do shows like Evil Dead the Musical in the evening. That's not for the whole family. But Berenstain Bears on Stage is for the whole family.
Well, you also have other programs for summer camp for kids and things like that. Can you talk to us about the other programs offered at Sutter Street Theater?
We have classes all of the time in all of the arts, including oil painting. But we also have, in the summer, we have, first of all, the third week of June, we start our performing and fine arts camp. And it goes from 9 to 2. And the kids study all of the arts. They get a little bit of dance movement. They get a little bit of music. They get a little bit of acting. And they do an oil painting. And the oil painting guaranteed you'll want to put it on your wall. But they do all four of these. And at the end of the week, they have a little performance and an art reception and a party.
We've been doing it for 25 years. We originally started in El Dorado Hills. And then we've done it at City College. Hired us to do it several years. And we've done it at Natomas Charter and Sacramento High. Just we've done it various spaces in the last 15 years. Obviously, we've done it here.
How about the other ongoing productions like Old Time Radio?
Old Time Radio is fun. We do that every second Saturday at 4:00. And it is actually as if you're going into and watching an old time radio show being produced on the air. But you're in the studio audience, and we use the original scripts, Fibber McGee and Molly, the Bickersons, Gunsmoke, the Shadow Knows, all of these old radio shows. And then right beside all of the actors is the Foley artist, which does all of the sound effects that you would have heard on the radio. So it's a lot of fun.
That program actually was the National Endowment for the Arts mm-hmm. helped us get that going. And once things loosen up, it'll be able to travel to some of the senior citizens' homes that can't travel.
Yeah.
And it's fun. We go in, we have costumes on, we have the old fur coats that are a no-no now. And the stoles and the hats and the longer dresses, and then the men are all dressed as if, you know, the period.
And between each show, we have each different individual show within the show, we have live music of the era.
That is great that you actually go into places where people, you know, it's tough for them to get out and to actually go experience art and just performances in person. Yeah. When it comes to the productions that you have, especially Bernstein Bears, how can people come and enjoy, if you can just kind of talk to them about the logistics, when it actually airs, how people can watch it, and also any of the protocols that are being taken place for safety?
Well, you have to call in because we're social distance, which means every show has a different seating
chart.
And you're going to have to be masked still. And then the cast is masked. They pull them down to sing, but they're all social distance too. And then we we just spent $5,000 on a HEPA machine, and it's not the little ones like that you get when you're in your doctor's. It's like 5 feet tall, turns the air over totally 7 times an hour for the theater. And if you're masked in the theater, you have, it's just like an airplane, a 0.0003% chance of catching COVID.
Of catching anything.
Yeah. Wow. But it really helps. And you're not going to be too close to anybody unless you, if you're grouped, you know, family. And so you have to buy the tickets. We don't have any online right now because that's down so that we can control who's coming in and where they're going to sit and stuff. So,
well, Mike, and
our phone number is 916-353-1001.
And we have that information all on our website. Mike Kimena and Connie Mockenhop, thank you so much for joining us and wish you just all the success this summer with the Bernstein Bears and other productions.
We appreciate this so much.
All right. Well, that's Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We're going to catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.